Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA LP 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio. I'm your host, Steve Diamond, and today is June 10th, 2006. Our focus today is on federal priorities and militarism. Here's what's coming up. After the news, we'll hear a recent speech featuring Ben Cohen of the Priorities Campaign and True Majority, and Ben and Jerry's Ice Cream, and Lawrence Korb of the Center for American Progress, followed by Lawrence Korb being interviewed. In our second hour, we'll bring you short commentaries about militarism and politicized spending priorities. We'll end with Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. We'll also have music, announcements, and more, so stay with us. First, some news. This is Steve Diamond with News You Need to Know. Protesters arrested after disrupting Negroponte in Vermont. By Oren Langell and Ann Peterman of the Global Justice Ecology Project. National Intelligence Director John Negroponte's commencement address to the graduating class of private St. Johnsbury Academy was disrupted twice by protesters inside the auditorium where the ceremony was being held. Over 75 protesters gathered on the sidewalk outside of the academy, protesting Negroponte's shadowy record that spans decades, including a stint as a U.S. ambassador to Honduras and ambassador to Iraq before his present position as the nation's number one intelligence overseer. Two other protesters from Vermont School of the Americas Watch were arrested as they attempted to gain entrance to the auditorium. Shortly after Negroponte began his address, Michael Colby, a horse logger from Worcester, Vermont, stood up and said, "In the name of democracy, I object to this man speaking. He has blood on his hands from his work in Central America and Iraq. He shouldn't be at the podium. He should be in jail. He is a war criminal." Colby was grabbed by police and security and escorted out of the auditorium to awaiting police cars. As Colby was being escorted away, Negroponte told the audience, "Now it's my turn." But before he could continue, Boots Wardinsky, another logger, quickly rose and said, "No, it's my turn." When the headmaster introduced Negroponte, he forgot to tell about all the people tortured, killed, and raped under Negroponte's helm in Honduras. "You should be ashamed to stay in here and listen to this man." Some of the protesters assembled outside started to move toward the auditorium. Palmer Lagar and Brendan O'Neill, both from Vermont School of the Americas Watch, were grabbed by the police and arrested. O'Neill shouted to reporters and bystanders, "They are arresting the wrong people. This man, Negroponte, teaches war, not peace. He is responsible for the murders of 30,000 innocent Nicaraguans." "Negroponte should have been arrested," stated Lagar as he was being arrested and put into a police car. He continued, "He is a war criminal." All four were arrested for disorderly conduct and trespass, although both Colby and Wardinsky had tickets allowing them inside for the Negroponte speech. Both Colby and Wardinsky represent Horse Loggers for Peace, and Wardinsky is also a member of Veterans for Peace. After the four were released, Colby said that he told the arresting officer that, "I come in peace." Colby said then the officer punched him in the stomach. Flyers handed out by protesters made the accusation that while Negroponte was ambassador to Honduras from 1981 to 1985, he collaborated with the Honduran military government overseeing one of the most scandalous and shameful periods of U.S. foreign policy, including an increase in military aid to Honduras from $4 million a year to over $77 million, an illegal and unauthorized Contra war against the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, increased collaboration between U.S. military, CIA, Honduran military, and the Nicaraguan Contras, forming paramilitary death squads, secret torture and detention camps, and widespread assassinations of peace and justice activists, the disappearance of 32 American women's social justice church leaders, and the now-famous Iran-Contra scandal, after the U.S. Congress voted to withdraw support for the war due to widespread human rights abuses by the Contras. Longtime activist Brian Tokar told reporters, "It's outrageous that he's being given a position of honor in our community." And in other news, Save Our Groundwater petitions for reconsideration. Following the New Hampshire Supreme Court's rejection of their appeal to the state's granting of a public license to USA Springs, Save Our Groundwater, along with the towns of Nottingham and Barrington, is petitioning the court for reconsideration. One especially galling aspect of the court's decision was its equation of the so-called need for bottled water with the fact that a market exists for it. To read Save Our Groundwater's motion for reconsideration, go to www.appealslawyer.net. And from citizenstrade.org, Oman Free Trade Agreement. Opposition to the proposed trade agreement with Oman is growing. The New Hampshire AFL-CIO has just endorsed the following statement. You can read it in full from www.citizenstrade.org. Congress should reject the Oman Free Trade Agreement. It contains investment provisions even more damaging to the ability of government to act in the public interest than NAFTA or CAFTA. Omani labor law does not meet core ILO labor standards, which call for workers to be able to form their own organizations free of interference from employers or government. Omani labor law gives the government an entirely inappropriate level of oversight and control over the activities, meetings, finances, and selection of representatives of the National and Industrial Worker Representative Committees. It fails to explicitly protect workers who participate in these committees or who engage in strikes from anti-union discrimination. While all workers in Oman are denied basic labor rights, the large foreign workforce, the majority of workers in Oman, are especially vulnerable to abuse and exploitation. The State Department has found both forced labor and human trafficking in Oman. As in other recent free trade areas negotiated by the U.S., the Oman Free Trade Agreement includes provisions in the investment chapter that allow private and state-owned companies to bring challenges against the United States directly to international tribunals, completely bypassing our country's legal system. The Oman Free Trade Agreement goes even further than NAFTA and CAFTA in giving foreign investors the right to challenge the U.S. It provides an explicit right to private and state-owned foreign entities to bring disputes challenging virtually any U.S. government decision about a federal contract, lease, or concession agreement with the company. The types of contracts and other agreements covered by the agreement include natural resource contracts, including exploration, extraction, refining, transportation, distribution, or sale, and many other types of contracts. And from alternet.org, librarians defy the FBI. The FBI has ordered four Connecticut librarians to turn over patrons' library records and to keep quiet about it. The librarians have refused to do either. And that was News You Need to Know.
This is Steve Capron for Making Waves, and we are at the Pearl in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, for the kickoff meeting of Priorities New Hampshire with Ben Cohen and Larry Korb. Peter Eggleston is making the introductions, and let's join that meeting in progress.
I want to thank all of you for coming on this sultry evening, and I want to welcome Ben to Portsmouth and turn the microphone over to him. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks so much, Peter. It's been great to have the support of Peter and Mary Jo in terms of putting this event together. Well, you know, a lot of people want to know how exactly it is that I got to be where I am today. And I got to tell you that it all started off in seventh grade gym class. That's where I met Jerry. We were the two slowest, fattest kids in the class. And there'd be the whole class running around the track, and then half a lap behind would be me and Jerry. And, you know, you get to make pretty good friends with whoever you can find back there at the back of the pack. So, you know, it's good to be here in the home of our neighbors to the east. I know that it's kind of unusual for a national campaign to be based up here in northern New England, but it gives us Vermonters and you Granite Staters a chance to inject some Yankee common sense into the national debate. So, you know, I could say that it was a strategic move to locate our office in northern Vermont, but it wasn't. You know, Priorities New Hampshire grew out of two bipartisan national organizations. One is Business Leaders for Sensible Priorities, a group of 700 business leaders around the country that are focused on our changing our national budget priorities, and TrueMajority.org, which is an online organization of over 500,000 Americans that grew out of Business Leaders for Sensible Priorities. These business leaders were concerned about the idea that we live in the richest country in the world, and yet our schools are so underfunded, and our healthcare system is a mess, and lots of kids don't have any access to healthcare at all. So as business people, we started to address this problem by looking at the federal budget, because, you know, that's what we were kind of used to doing as business people. Now, I know the federal budget, you know, is a big, dry thing, but I happen to have brought a copy of it here with me today.
This is the federal discretionary budget. You know, there's another part of the federal budget called the mandatory budget, which deals with things that have to be spent every year. Interest on the national debt, Social Security, various other government overhead, and entitlements. But this is the amount of money, which lately is about $900 billion, that Congress has the ability each year to spend as it sees fit. And so whenever you hear them talk about the federal budget, they're always talking about this one, the discretionary budget. And as you can see, the Pentagon takes up 50% of it, and that's why things like education, housing, the environment, human services get all these little slices. What we said at the priorities campaign is, well, you know, this Pentagon budget only grew to be 50% during the Cold War. And now that the Cold War is over and the U.S. is the world's only superpower, couldn't we afford to reduce some of that money spent on the Pentagon and then use it to fund some of these other issues? So we said, well, that's the way it looks to us as business guys, but, you know, we're just business guys. What do we know? We'll have to talk to some military experts. So we put together a board of military advisors, including Admiral Stansfield Turner, the former director of the CIA, Admiral Jack Shanahan, the former commander of the North Atlantic Fleet, Larry Korb, former Assistant Secretary of Defense to Ronald Reagan, who's here with us tonight, and a bunch of others. And they said, yeah, that's true. We are still building weapons designed to defeat the former Soviet Union. They're no longer needed, and there's actually $60 billion worth of unneeded Pentagon expenditures that can be used for other things. And that's what that slice represents. So then we said, well, how does the public feel about this? So we did a bunch of polling over the years, both before 9/11 and after 9/11, nationally and in New Hampshire specifically. And the polls consistently show that the people of the United States, two-thirds of all people in the United States, want to shift an average of about 30% out of the Pentagon into those other discretionary programs. And we're conservative. We're only looking to do about 15%. And then it's interestingly enough, after 9/11, the public was asked, how should we pay for the spending that's necessary to protect ourselves from terrorism? Should we increase the Pentagon budget, or should we redirect some of the money in the Pentagon budget from whatever it's currently being used for to what today's threat is? And the population, by a huge majority, said we should redirect it, but that's not what we did. So the public gets it because it's just common sense. You know, many people are focused on problems. Our campaign is focused on solutions. People are in favor of transferring the money, but it's not top of mind. It's not something that they're thinking about. And so politicians feel like they don't have to address it. So we decided to work with our members in New Hampshire and Iowa to get this issue to be top of mind. Now, New Hampshire and Iowa are both small states. We can kind of be a big fish in a little pond. And every 4 years, they're giant fishbowls where the eyes of the nation are on these two states. And our plan is to be active in this campaign day after day, year after year, from now until 2012, to continually build an ever-growing constituency of people that see switching national budget priorities as a top priority for them. So the idea is to force politicians to start listening to us for a change instead of having us sit there and listen to them, and to get them to finally start putting their money where their mouth is. The campaign is based on the good old Yankee values of being thrifty and cutting waste, being fiscally conservative because it doesn't require any additional taxes, and having a positive vision, caring about the needs of our communities. Here in New Hampshire, the priority issues of the Business and Industry Association actually do include healthcare, economic growth, and the cost of energy.
In addition, other concerns right here in New Hampshire is that school districts are struggling to fund the basics, and there's 17,000 kids that lack any access to health care. Priorities New Hampshire campaign provides a solution for all of these. In fact, New Hampshire would end up getting $155 million a year every year. The specifics of the campaign are embodied in a bill that was recently introduced to Congress called the Common Sense Budget Act. And I'd like to show you how that works. Now, I'm a dessert guy, and you know, this is somewhat of a complex problem. So I don't know about you, but when I think about complex problems, I think about dessert. And it occurred to me that the perfect dessert to deal with this particular problem is Oreo cookies. So if you'll excuse me, what I have here is essentially a bar chart that's constructed of oversized Oreo cookies. And on this bar chart, every Oreo cookie equals $10 billion. So what we have here is a stack of 46 cookies that represents the Pentagon budget, $460 billion a year. And what I'd like to do now is show you what we spend on some of those other programs in comparison, if somebody can give me a chair or a step stool.
Right here. I got one right here.
Thank you, sir. Very nicely done. Yes, I am now going to move the money. Here's one Oreo. That's $10 billion, $20 billion, $30 billion, $40 billion, $50 billion, $60 billion. So this is what the Common Sense Budget Act says. Take $60 billion out of the Pentagon and use it for some of these other areas. Now, actually, we currently do spend some money on those other areas, and here's an idea of how much we spend. We spend $50 billion on education K-12 at the federal level. We spend one Oreo, $10 billion, on world hunger. We spend four Oreos each year on children's health care. We spend three-quarters of an Oreo on job training. We spend a quarter of an Oreo on energy independence. And we spend zero on reducing the national debt. Now, all we're saying, as the priorities can't say, is take one of these Oreos, put it on education. That's $10 billion a year. Over a period of 12 years, that's enough money to rebuild every one of our public schools in America that needs it. Take another Oreo off, put it on world hunger. Take one more, split it in half. You've all done this before. Half on world hunger, that would be 1.5 Oreos, $15 billion. For $15 billion a year, you could provide food self-sufficiency for all of the 6 million kids every year that are dying of starvation. Take another Oreo, put it on children's health care, and that would be enough money, $10 billion a year, to take care of every child in the United States that currently doesn't have health care. Take one more Oreo off, put it on, well, put half of it on job training, and that's enough to provide job training for another 250,000 people a year that are laid off. Take that last Oreo, put it on energy independence, and that would be enough money over 10 years. $10 billion a year for 10 years is enough money to reduce our need for oil by 50%. And take the last one, put it back together, put it on deficit reduction, and that at least starts to reduce the deficit by $10 billion a year. Now, this clearly is a very appreciative audience.
Yeah.
But sometimes I do this, and people say, well, what does that prove? That just proves that Fed can move a bunch of Oreos around on a chart, but isn't that going to leave us vulnerable
to our potential adversaries. Well, the fact of the matter is that outside of the United States, the countries that are not currently our allies, so the potential adversaries, countries that are not currently our allies, the biggest one would be Russia. And Russia currently spends $70 billion a year. The next biggest one is China. China spends $60 billion a year. And the countries that we're concerned about, that would be Iran, Libya, Syria, North Korea, and Cuba, the axis of evil plus, a grand total, all between them, all together, of one Oreo cup. So, as you can see, even after we took off enough Oreos to take care of all those social needs, there's still more than enough to go around to take care of those guys. People want to know, what is it that you're going to cut? Someone was just calling to find that out. And I want to give you just one example, and then Dr. Korb will go into more detail on it. You know, the United States currently spends about $20 billion a year on its nuclear arsenal. And what I'd like to do is give you a demonstration of what we get for that amount of money. What I'm going to do is I'm going to drop some BBs into this bucket. Now, here's one BB. That represents the equivalent of 15 Hiroshima-sized bombs. Now, here's six BBs. That represents enough nuclear explosive power to blow up all of Russia. And now I'm going to pour in the amount of BBs that represents our total nuclear arsenal. That was 10,000 BBs, the equivalent of 150,000 Hiroshima-sized bombs. That's actually enough nuclear weapons to blow up the entire world 10 times over. Well, our military advisors took a look at this and they said, we'd be happy if we could just blow up the entire world 4 times over. And that would end up saving $10 billion a year every year. And that's just one example of the Cold War mentality that still pervades the Pentagon. Well, I'll tell you, it might not taste as good as ice cream, but it sure makes for a sweeter world. That's really what the priorities campaign is about. And transferring this money from things that have no use, have no purpose, to crying needs in the communities makes a lot of common sense. And so I just can't tell you how appreciative I am of you all coming out here tonight and sweating together with us. And I look forward to working with you over the coming years. And now, Dr. Korb, is that what I'm supposed to do?
Ben is a tough act to follow. Let me make a couple of points about defense spending, which I think is very important, because somebody's going to say, wait a second, Korb and Cohen, you guys want to cut defense budget in the middle of a war. You can't do that. This $460 billion has nothing to do with the war. That's funded separately. Congressman Barney Frank from Massachusetts once said, you know, we spend $500 billion a year on defense. We've got to pay extra to use it. And we do. We don't fund, what we're talking about here has nothing to do with funding the war, so it will have no impact on those brave men and women, you know, who are over there in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places around the world. The next thing to keep in mind is what we're talking about here in terms of funding is going to make us more secure. Because if you can deal with world hunger, you're going to have a big impact on why people resort to terrorism and join some of these groups. So it will make us more secure. If you're energy independent or less dependent on countries like Saudi Arabia, for example, it's going to increase your ability to do what you need to do. You know, people forget 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. But since we use them as a gas station, there's really not too much, you know, that we can do about it. So keep that in mind. Now, Ben started off talking about the nuclear thing. And, you know, if you take a look at, for example, how many nuclear weapons we have about 10,000. If you talk to people like General Habinger, who was the last commander of the Strategic Command, say, how many do you really need? He would tell you, in fact, I was with him yesterday in Chicago, 600 operational, 400 in reserve. So you go down to 1,000. And that's how you would save a lot of this money. And more than that, you would not only save money, but you would send the right signal to the world. The greatest danger to us is nuclear weapons falling into the hands of a violent extremist or a terrorist with a global reach. And the way to stop that is to stop the proliferation of nuclear weapons. And the way to do that is with the world's largest nuclear power to set the example. And if we were to get up and say, look, we're going to go from 10,000 to 1,000 nuclear weapons, it would go a long way toward dealing with crisis, for example, like Iran. Not only are we not getting rid of all that we should, this administration is trying to develop new nuclear weapons. And were it not for the Congress, we would actually be far down that path. And they want new nuclear weapons at a time when we're telling other countries not to get them. You know, the El Baradei, who's the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the man who inspects, he says, we're like the people, you know, standing there with a cigarette telling other people not to smoke. It's simply not going to work. So you could save money doing it. The next thing that, in terms of money, we're developing this national missile defense system. Now, I was there in the Reagan administration when we started this. But Ronald Reagan wanted to have a national missile defense system so you could get rid of all nuclear weapons. He tried to do it at Reykjavik. And the idea was if you got rid of all nuclear weapons, then you would have this system in case somebody else developed them. But the one thing about President Reagan is toward the end of his administration, some of what we take called neoconservatives said, you know, you got to deploy it because these other people may not be as enthusiastic. And he said, you can't deploy something that doesn't work. Well, that's what we've done. Under this administration, we have actually deployed a national missile defense system. We're spending about $11 billion a year on a national missile defense system. We've actually deployed it. We put them in California. We put it in Alaska. We have not tested it in 5 years. And if, in fact, you did test it, every scientist I've talked to said it simply won't work because the other side, be it North Korea, whoever might want to use these things, with decoys, they can easily overwhelm the system. But most importantly, if you look at what the threats, and somebody wants to use a nuclear weapon at the United States, the last thing they're going to do is fire it at you because it would have a return address. And while somebody might have one or two, we have 10,000. Okay? They're not going to do that. They're going to try and smuggle it in a container. And do you know we spend more on one system, the National Missile Defense System, than the entire Coast Guard? The entire Coast Guard. And I'm not talking about just inspecting things coming into the country. All of the other wonderful things that the Coast Guard does. Their budget is $8 billion, and here we're spending $11 billion on one system. So we argue in the paper, okay, let's keep it as a research and development. You never know what's going to happen, so let's keep it. And rather than $11 billion, spend $3 billion a year, which is still a pretty good amount. So we're not, and as Ben pointed out, we're not, you know, we're being conservative here. We don't say get rid of all nuclear weapons, go down to 1,000. Keep this in a research and development program. Then when you move into conventional weapons, non-nuclear weapons, a couple of systems, you need to take a look at. Back when I was in government, the Air Force developed this weapon system called the FA-22. It's a fighter plane. It was built to keep up with the next generation of Soviet MiGs. Okay? They started that one, and I left the Pentagon 20 years ago. Okay? There's no Soviet next generation of MiG, and this is a wonderful fighter plane. Goes twice the speed of sound and, you know, do all these wonderful things. But what do you need it for today? And do you know how much it costs? $360 million per plane. Okay? And so what we say, and again, they've got 100 of them. We said, stop at 100. You don't need to keep going. Okay? So we take a look at that. The Navy is building a new destroyer. It's called the DDX. Okay? Great for open ocean warfare. But I don't think the Japanese are coming back again, and we're not going to have... And even the Marines are saying, why do we need this? You need to put things to help us ashore. And in our paper, we talk about the literal combat ship that can support the troops ashore, not something for ocean open warfare. Now, just to show you, we're, you know, bipartisan here. When I first met Ben, it was 1995, I had written an article in Foreign Affairs about the money that Bill Clinton was wasting in the defense budget. Let me mention a couple of weapon systems. The Marines have this plane, it's called the V-22. It takes off like a helicopter, flies like a plane. All right. Dick Cheney, when he was Secretary of Defense, called it a turkey. He said, you know, it's very expensive, and it's got such technological problems. I don't know if any of you are pilots. I spent a couple of years in the Navy as a naval flight officer, but the tolerance is so small on that when you transition from flying like an airplane back to a helicopter. It's tough enough when nobody's shooting at you. Okay, but if somebody, and we have lost dozens of Marines in the crashes. Again, this was started 20 years ago. We have spent close to $20 billion. You know how many we got that work? None. But we're going with it because Bill Clinton, trying to show he was tough on defense, and of course there were votes in Pennsylvania and Texas, he resurrected it. And so this thing is going on and on. Now, of course, when Cheney ran for vice president and went to Pennsylvania, he said he was wrong. But the fact of the matter is this weapon system just doesn't work. There's a cargo plane or transport plane called the C-130J. If any of you have been in the service, C-130 is a terrific plane. The problem, the J model, okay, it's got like 57 operational deficiencies. Don Rumsfeld tried to cancel it. And the Georgia delegation said, no, we built down there, you know, in Marietta, so he had to back off. And by the way, Rumsfeld tried to cancel the FA-22, and the Secretary of the Air Force said he would resign. Now, this is the fellow, you know, that did the Boeing deal. If you followed that, he probably should have let him. Now, if you think, and if you get, and in our report, we point out all of the Boeing emails. So you talk about how it works. They asked the Air Force, do you need new tankers? The Air Force said, no, we don't need new tankers. These are, you know, to refuel the planes. The ones we have will last us another 40 years. And then Boeing said, hey, we can make you a good deal. So they changed the analysis to show that they needed one. And then, of course, they gave the contract to Boeing. And, of course, the Air Force didn't have enough money to pay for it. Because the way it works in the Pentagon, it's not like a home mortgage. When you buy it, you got to pay the whole cost of it. So they said, no, we'll lease them to you. So you can won't look very much in the in-year, you know, in the next couple of years, but then we'll sell them to you. And who stopped them? John McCain. He said, wait a second, what are you doing? And he demanded and got all of the emails. And so we take a look at it and say, look, you know, these are the type of things you're doing. When I've done two reports with Ben. The first one I did in 2000, and I recommended canceling two weapon systems. A Crusader, which is an artillery system, and the Comanche, which is an Army helicopter. And everybody said, oh, you guys are going to ruin our defense and everything. They've been canceled in the last 5 years. Had we listened to Ben back there in 2000, we'd have had $11 billion we spent on two weapon systems, you know, that don't work. So you take a look at our weapon systems, ones you don't need, ones that don't work. And then the next thing we talk about is space. Now, the military is very dependent on space. And the idea, you know, if the GPS system, you know, the military uses like we all do. And right now you have the best of all possible worlds because basically you can use space to enhance your military capabilities. That's the militarization of space. But Don Rumsfeld wants to weaponize it. He wants to shoot stuff from space at other people. Well, let me tell you something. You start doing that, and other people are not going to let you have those satellites and stuff up there. And besides, it's much more expensive. It's 166 times more expensive to shoot something from space than to shoot a missile, you know, down here on the ground. And we take a look at that and say, that doesn't make any sense to spend this money. Now, part of the problem we have is it's what they call the black program. And, you know, I've been tracking defense budget for years. It's black. It means that you can't have a debate, public debate about it. 20% of all of the programs now are black. What that tells me is they don't want any debates about it. They don't want you and I and the members of the Congress to take a look at these. So we say, hey, let's militarize space, but don't weaponize it. And then finally, if you take a look at, you know, Don Rumsfeld says, you know, he could save $20 billion a year in defense if he could run it more efficiently. And we say, you've been there 5 years. What are you waiting for? Okay? And the other thing is, you know, with the Congress, you know, there were almost 3,000 earmarks in last year's defense budget. 3,000 projects specified that weren't asked for by the Pentagon, okay? 3,000. Now, again, we're very conservative. We say, you know, if you shape up, you can save another $5 billion in order to do this. Now, if you do that, you will basically be able to use that money. And I'm not an expert in these other areas. I mean, I talked about what could increase. I'm not going to tell you where to spend it. But I can tell you, you can take that money without impact. I haven't cut a single Army troop or single Marine or the National Guard or anything like that, okay? These are the people bearing the burden. And by the way, we at the place I work, the Center for American Progress, we sponsored the filming of the Faces of War with the New Hampshire National Guard. And I really urge you to see it because we had a panel down at the Tribeca Film Festival and I got to meet those brave young people and their families. We're not talking about that. We're talking about stuff that deals with a threat from a bygone era. And if you do that, you'll be able to do these things, which in the long run will make us more secure. Thank you very much for your attention.
Dr. Larry Kaur, former Assistant Secretary of Defense under Ronald Reagan.
Following the event, Making Waves' own Steve Capron had the opportunity to interview Lawrence Kaur.
This is Steve Capron. We are at the Pearl, and we are here for an interview with Larry Kaur, who was Assistant Secretary of Defense during the Reagan administration and has since that time been active in research about defense spending for the last 20 years or so, isn't it?
It sure has.
Mr. Kaur, welcome to New Hampshire.
It's nice to be here.
You just finished a presentation with Ben Cohen of Ben & Jerry's fame about what we're doing with defense spending. You've been sending the message for 20 years or so that we're spending too much. Is that pretty much what you've seen over these last years?
Yeah, we're spending money on things that don't contribute to our national security, money that could be better spent elsewhere in the federal budget.
Now, is this a product of what Eisenhower referred to as the military-industrial complex? Are there just too many people with too much to gain by having these inflated programs, or is it the Congress doing pork barrel? What's behind all this?
Eisenhower called it the military-industrial complex because he was trying to hold down defense spending, and the Congress and a lot of people overreacting to what happened with Sputnik forced him to raise it. But it's really the military-industrial congressional complex that leads us to spend money on things that serve their interests rather than the nation's interest.
So is this, would you relate this to the high cost of running for office these days, that therefore contributions and lobbyists and so forth are more and more important to getting and staying in Congress?
There's no doubt about the fact that the increasing cost of running for office at the national level particularly gets people in to all kinds of special interests that makes it harder for them to act for the interests of the country rather than the people who helped them get into office.
Well, what's the answer to this? Is the answer organizations like yours just pointing it out over and over again, or is there any systemic change that you think should be brought about to correct this?
I think the main thing is that groups like Business Leaders for Sensible Priorities point out what's happening when you give in to these special interests, that you get things that don't contribute to the national security and prevent you from spending money on things that would actually contribute to national security.
You've written about the changing role of the reserves and what they're being asked to do now that they have not been traditionally asked to do. Can you tell us a little your thoughts on that?
Well, the National Guard and Reserve, as we call both of them, the reserve component, was supposed to be a bridge between the active force and going back to a draft. But what's happened as we fought the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, particularly Iraq, the Guard and Reserve have become an end unto themselves, and they've been used much more than they were ever intended. The rule of thumb should be that a man or woman in the Guard and Reserve should serve no more than 1 year out of every six on active duty. That rule has been, you know, blatantly ignored ever since we invaded Iraq.
That was a rule of thumb, or was it a law, or?
No, it was not a law, but the idea was that you would be then asking a man or woman to spend no more than 20% of their time on active duty. It was also a practical thing that if you wanted to keep a person in the Guard and Reserve, and if you used it more than that, the chances are they wouldn't stay in, because they would basically mean that they would be adjuncts to the active duty force, and the reason many of them didn't go on active duty or left active duty to join the Guard and Reserve is because they wanted to pursue other interests or had family concerns.
We've noticed in this area that not only is it a hardship for the people themselves and their families, but it's turned out to be a hardship for the communities, because very often the kind of people who are in the reserves are firefighters and policemen and EMTs and all sorts of people who play some pretty vital role, particularly in rural areas, and they have been subtracted in great numbers from these.
There's no doubt about it. After September 11th, what we call homeland defense has become a much more urgent national priority. And if you take people, particularly in the Guard, who are first responders away, it's a double hit to the communities, because the first responders won't be there in case of a man-made or natural disaster, and the backup won't be there. And we saw that, I think, in great graphic detail during when Katrina hit. The best units in the Louisiana and Mississippi Guards were actually in bag, not only the best units, but their equipment. And I think we'll find out that there was more damage caused than should have been, because those people were not there when they needed them to be there. And so what you need to do is you need to make sure that the Guard particularly gives priority to this homeland defense mission.
You've also written quite a bit about Secretary Rumsfeld. Where did you put him in regard to this excessive spending on the military?
Well, I think what Secretary Rumsfeld basically has not made the hard choices that you need to make to keep the defense budget within bounds. Basically, what he's done is he's pushed the problem off to the next administration. Even if you don't cut the defense budget like we've been talking about, and you get the money that Bush has in there, they can't afford all of the weapon systems that they have under development. And whoever succeeds President Bush in 2009 or succeeds Don Rumsfeld in the Pentagon is going to have to make some hard choices, because our deficit is so high, there's no feeling in the country that we can raise taxes, so you have to make some hard choices. Rumsfeld came in determined to make some of them. He was beaten back, interesting, in his first 8 months by the military-industrial complex, and then, of course, the war came. People felt that in what his quadrennial defense review that came out early in 2006, he would make the hard choices, but he simply didn't, because he'd been so consumed by the war.
What do you think of his conduct of that war?
Well, I think that he needs to take responsibility for the way in which we prosecuted the war. I think the administration is responsible for the reasons we got into, which turned out not to be true, because they basically cherry-picked the intelligence to tell them what they wanted to hear. But Rumsfeld, I think, bears responsibility for not having a plan to deal with what the military called phase four, or the post-major conflict phase. We simply didn't have enough troops, nor did they have the right guidance to get Iraq under control after we got rid of Saddam Hussein, and today we're paying the penalty for that.
Now, what is it about the Department of Defense, or perhaps the government in general, that has a man like this whose decisions have been so discredited and have been so unsuccessful to remain exactly where he is year after year?
Well, I think the reason is that the president doesn't want to get rid of him because the president then would have to admit that he had some responsibility for the horrible things that have happened in Iraq. And I think that this whole administration, there's no accountability. Paul Wolfowitz, who was Rumsfeld's deputy, who basically told General Shinseki, the Army Chief of Staff, that he didn't know what he was talking about when it came to the number of troops that would be needed in Iraq, he's now making $300,000 tax-free at the World Bank. Ambassador Bremer, who went over there and didn't press the case for more troops, he's got the Medal of Freedom, and you know, he's made $100,000 on a book. General Franks, who was the Army general in charge, you know, he's made several million dollars on his book and speeches. George Tenet, who gave the president wrong intelligence or didn't stand up to him when the president didn't want to listen, you know, he gets the Medal of Freedom. So this whole, there's no accountability at all for the horrible decisions that have been made. And that's so much different. You know, after Pearl Harbor, we court-martialed General Short and Admiral Kimmel. Not that they were bad people, but they were accountable. There's no accountability in this administration.
Well, in that regard, do you have contacts in the Pentagon of officers who are, I guess what you'd call the middle ranks of officers? And what do they think about Rumsfeld's policies? The people very close to him are sort of marching in step, but you'd expect that. But if you go back a bit into the professional military, what do they think about this?
Well, basically, they think that they're going to be left holding the bag and be blamed for decisions that he made, that he put them in an impossible situation. And unlike them, where they make a mistake, they're held accountable. He has not been accountable. What they really worry about is what kind of army will be left whenever we can get out of Iraq, because right now one out of every six people joining the army is getting a waiver. 97% of the captains made major because so many people got out at the end of their first tour. And they're worried about the long-term health of the army, which took a long time to build and get right after we ended the draft after Vietnam.
Do you think that the assignment that the army has in Iraq is an assignment that an army can really carry out successfully?
The army cannot carry it out with the number of troops that they've been given. The other problem was this administration came in against the whole idea of nation building, and so they didn't give the army the right tools or guidance to carry it out. And they're in an impossible situation. They don't have enough troops to get the situation under control, but they have just enough to get themselves in the middle of all of the problems going on there. And it took them a while. I mean, they're finally understanding the situation now, but it may be too late because they were not given the proper guidance of what to do when Saddam Hussein fell. You may remember when the rioting first broke out, Rumsfeld said, well, they're sort of dead enders and this happens, and not realizing it was giving birth to an insurgency. And I really feel, my heart goes out to the young men and young women on the ground over there, because they don't know who's friend or foe, who's the enemy, who's not, who they can trust. And they're in a foreign culture, they don't speak the language, so it becomes very difficult for them to be able to perform almost an impossible mission.
What do you think that the long-term effects are going to be on the whole, on the military as we have come to see it these days, the volunteer army, the large reserve force? What is all this going to do to that? Is it?
Well, what you're going to have is a much lower quality in terms of educational backgrounds, aptitude, and experience. The army that we take out of Iraq will not nearly be as good as the army we put in. And the real question is, how bad will it be and how long will it take to fix? Not only the personnel, you're burning up equipment there much more rapidly than normal, and there's no money put aside to what we call reset the army.
What do you see as how events will transpire over there? Do you think we're in there for years and years, or will the American people just not accept being there for that period of time?
Well, I think the administration can't continue on its present course. The president has said that it's going to be up to a successor, you know, to make the decision, which in my view is an irresponsible statement. They're basically just hoping that some event will turn things around, you know, whether it's the election, the permanent government, whether you get the ministers of interior, and they keep hoping because right now they just don't know what to do and they have no plan to deal with it. I mean, if they were to ask me, I would say that you need to set a timetable for withdrawal. You need to send a message you don't have any designs on permanent basis there and give the Iraqi government an incentive to do what they need to do to make the compromises necessary to get the people to support this notion of Iraqiness, which they never have.
Do you think that there's practically a consensus on this, but do you agree with those who say that we made a great mistake in not keeping the Iraqi military and police and the Ba'athist party administrative structure and the elements of government, that this was a great error to have just disbanded everybody?
We went too far. Obviously, we wanted to get rid of the top leaders, but there were many people who joined the Ba'athist Party, like people in Eastern Europe joined the Communist Party to get ahead. They were not committed, and your problem was that you threw out the baby with the bath, and you had to start from scratch, and then you try to do it so quickly that you ended up with a force that's been infiltrated by the various militias and the various insurgents, and now you have the worst of all possible worlds. You have a force that you are supposed to be protecting them, but yet you can't count on it to protect it. They're not loyal to Iraq as a whole, but to their own sect or tribe or insurgent group. And really what's happened now is the civil war is a greater threat than the insurgency. So the idea that you're fighting them there so you don't have to fight them here, if in fact it was ever true, is no longer true, because right now the real problem is sectarian violence.
We find ourselves once again somewhat isolated in the world. There's practically a universal dislike of what we're doing in Iraq, and we never did go and seek that support from the rest of the world in the first place. Do you think that is something that we should have done?
Well, I think if you're going to wage a preventive war as opposed to preemption, in other words, Saddam was not an immediate threat. If you wanted to deal with him, you would be much better to have the international community on your side, because then it would be seen as legitimate. You would get more support. The president should have done it the way his father did when getting rid of Saddam from Kuwait. He got the UN resolution, and then he, you know, asked the Congress after the UN had supported it. We had nations sent over 200,000 troops to the first Persian Gulf War. We also know that he could have waited to let the inspectors find out when they got back in there that, in fact, there was nothing there. Because we had said we knew where they were, we told Dr. Blix, and he went and they weren't there. And yet there was no real reason to rush, other than the fact that the president decided he was going to go, whether the UN supported it or not. Because even after he went to the UN, we ended up with 300,000 troops in the theater in what the military would call a use-it-or-lose-it proposition.
You were not in the first Bush administration, but no. There seems to be such a huge difference between the son and the dad. And so many of the people who worked for the first George Bush have come out in opposition to the policies of his son. And when you compare the attitudes and behavior of the two Bushes, they seem so very different. Do you think he's talking to Dad at all, or talking and not listening? Or?
Well, the only thing I know is if you read James Risen's book, the New York Times reporter who revealed the NSA wiretaps, he has a section in there in which he says that the father, Bush 41, or the first President Bush, called his son and said, stop paying attention to Rumsfeld and all those neoconservatives. Now, according to Risen, the current president hung up on him. Now, I don't know if that is true, but we certainly know that Brent Scowcroft is very upset. He's given interviews. He's written, you know, op-ed things to try and slow them down. The difference between, I think, both the Reagan administration and the first president, which I didn't work for him, but I worked in his 88 campaign, was that basically they were much more realistic about what the U.S. should do and how it should protect its security. I mean, the first President Bush said, well, you know, after the first Persian Gulf War, why didn't you go to Baghdad? He said, well, then what would you do when you got there? You'd have to run the place, and, you know. And obviously, after September 11th, this president decided he couldn't do that. And he had a group of advisors around him who we now call them the neoconservatives. These were people who've been building up over the years. They were in the Reagan administration with me, but they were balanced by the Nixon, Ford, sort of realistic Republicans. There's no real balance to them now because Vice President Cheney is their champion. And you have a president who doesn't come in with much foreign policy background and who has these grand visions of, you know, what he can accomplish. And the two sort of came together and got us into this mess.
With the Soviet threat gone and us not having that enemy or that menace to deal with, people now believe that it's the Muslims who are our enemy, or some Muslims. What do you think about that, and what do you think the military preparation for that should be?
Well, I mean, you have three kinds of enemies right now. You've got violent extremists, radical jihadists, whatever you want to call them. And terrorists is not the right word. You can't go to war against terrorism. That's a tactic. It's a group of radical jihadists, violent extremists who don't like our policies. They don't like the fact that we support governments that they don't think are true followers of Muslim, like Saudi Arabia. They don't like the fact that we station troops in the Holy Land. The second is what you might call extreme regimes like Iran and North Korea. And the third are weak and failing states. Those are your enemies that you have to deal with. To deal with these enemies, these violent extremists, you can't deter them or contain them. You have to preempt them, but not just by military force, with intelligence. You got to arrest them and dry up their financial assets. But when you're dealing with regimes, even evil regimes like North Korea, Iran, and Iraq, those leaders want to stay in power. They can be detained and deterred, as we deterred the Soviet Union. And you need to worry about weak and failing states because they become havens for terrorists. Now, the military that you need to do that is much different than your Cold War military. You know, national missile defense and F-22s is not going to be effective against them. It's going to be ground forces who are trained to do what we call peacekeeping or peacemaking and reconstruction and stabilization.
So there really isn't a military response to many of the threats that have been made and carried out by the jihadists. I mean, they essentially blow buildings up, they do things of this kind. You're not going to have a military force that can have much influence on that kind of thing. Is that an intelligence challenge to deal with that?
You have to use all the instruments of national power. Intelligence, obviously, diplomacy. Your what we call public diplomacy. I mean, you need to explain to people in that part of the world why what these violent extremists are saying is about us is not correct. The problem you face is when you go into Iraq for the wrong reasons, you have things like Abu Ghraib and Haditha. They play on that to get more converts. So you need to understand that in the long term, you can prevail against these people mainly by convincing people in the Arab and Muslim world that what they say is simply not true. And there are other reasons for the problems in that part of the world. It requires us to have an energy policy so we can have more freedom in dealing with Saudi Arabia, for example, which is one of the regimes that they do not like. And it requires us to, you know, things like when you have a Muslim country in Africa where you have horrible things happening, for us to go in and help them, because again, that sends the message. You know, when we went into Indonesia after the tsunami in late 2004, Indonesia is the largest Muslim country in the world. Before we sent the Marines in there to help them, American prestige was like 20%. After that, it went up to 80%. I mean, that was much more influential than destroying all of these people.
Do you think that the intelligence gathering ability of the country has been damaged by this, what you might call a purge that took place in the CIA over the last few years?
Yeah, I think that, you know, when Porter Goss came in there and was told to clean up the place and get rid of all of the people who were in the view of the administration, we're trying to undermine their policies. They got rid of a lot of professionals that they shouldn't have. Now, I think with General Hayden in there bringing back Steve Kappas, I think we're going, back to get the right people. But I think the real problem has been the morale, because they saw their, information that they provided abused for political aims, and that put them in a very difficult position, because they knew what the policymakers were saying was wrong, but they had to be careful about speaking out, because they're career people and they're, all of this stuff is classified.
Many people in the Bush administration seem to be following a strategy of find out who in any given agency is on the side you want them to be on, and don't invite the others to the meetings.
Well, this administration has a feeling that government people, career people in government, are all liberal Democrats and opposed to them, which is not true, and so therefore you can't trust them to be completely honest that they have some sort of other agenda, and it's simply not true, and therefore they treat with suspicion what the career people tell them, and that's why Rumsfeld set up the Office of Special Plans under Doug Feith, to look at the same intelligence that the CIA was, to come up with different conclusions.
You mentioned that somebody had been brought back to the CIA. Was that somebody who had been purged but has been brought back by the new director?
Yes. Steve Kappas was told by Porter Goss, chief of staff, to fire someone who was working for him. He wouldn't do that, and so he left. He was then the director of operations. He's now come back as the number two person under General Hayden.
Do you think that this general, who seems a very bright and professional guy, do you think he can do a little damage control and get that agency back?
Well, I think he has a good chance of restoring the morale of the agency. But remember, it's a different agency now, because the director of CIA used to be the director of Central Intelligence. Right now, that job is run by the Director of National Intelligence, John Negroponte. So General Hayden is not as powerful as George Tenet was, or Stan Turner, or any of the people who preceded him. So he's got a different job. But the CIA is still the one you rely on for providing human intelligence, and you want to make sure that you have the right people in there.
Changing the subject just a little bit, is the Department of Homeland Security as awful as people say it is?
Yeah, if anything, it's worse than people think. It's very interesting. People ask me, I think Rumsfeld should have gone there. They needed somebody like Rumsfeld to shape up the place and to get it to go. The Pentagon didn't need him, and he was telling them things, that our military was actually in pretty good shape when he came in. But you need a strong leader there. Tom Ridge was not, Chertoff is not. And I think, just if you take with FEMA, FEMA may have been a political dumping ground before 9/11, but after 9/11 you couldn't afford to do that. And basically the White House didn't even want the agency, then they saw Congress was going to do it, so you had four people sat in the White House basement in a weekend and came up with this scheme, which is really not the way you want to do things, particularly in the midst of a war. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'd like to thank you for taking the time. This was a wonderful meeting this evening. A lot of people from Portsmouth came to a little ice cream fest from Ben Cohen, from Ben and Jerry's, and also to presentations by Lawrence Korb and Ben Cohen having to do with what we're doing with the federal budget. Any final thoughts on that?
No, I think it's important that people understand the information so they can make the right choices, because I think a lot of times people think it's too hard and they shouldn't get involved. And I think what Ben has done is a tremendous job to get people to understand. I mean, just for example, how much we spend compared to our adversaries. Once you see that, then you say, well, maybe there is some money we can take out.
To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information, 430-9722.